can start now.
The year was already partially over. I don't know that Dartmouth could have found anyone to come in the middle of the year, but they didn't. So the result was that the half dozen of us who were taking the advanced organic chemistry course at Dartmouth gave ourselves our own advanced chemistry course. What we did was to get a copies of Bernstein and Sudborough. I don't think I own that book anymore. It was a Beilstein kind of book that presented the prep of this and the prep of that and the prep of the other thing in turn. A very standard, old-fashioned book. And we went through it chapter by chapter. For the preps, we took turns. And each one of us would go through the various books in the library, lab manuals, and pick out a preparation and assign it to the class. Mm-hmm. And each one of us would be responsible for going through the prep first, seeing that it worked, and then everyone else would do it. Well, there was no leadership. We didn't know what standards we were supposed to adhere to. Mm-hmm. The preps were an odd collection, as far as the lab was concerned. But sort of like my high school course in trigonometry, it had the great advantage of demonstrating that you can do it yourself. And it's a terrible lesson to learn from the point of view of someone who has been a teacher all his life. Because essentially it says that what I have been doing is totally unnecessary. But from the point of view of learning, the notion that you can do it yourself is an extraordinarily important one. So I think that was a good course in advanced organic chemistry, however little factual material I learned.
What were the labs like? Terms of equipment and so on.
You know, there wasn't any equipment. My statement about the labs, including the lab, a little unfairly, the lab at Harvard when I came here as a graduate student, is that if Emil Fischer had walked into those labs, he would have been astounded about Pyrex glass. But that's the only thing we had that he didn't. And fundamentally, I think that that is correct. Our distilling columns weren't much good, and I don't think were much better than those that had been available in 1910. We had at Harvard the beginnings of electrochemical measurements of acidity. Fisher would not have had that. But the only UV was photographic, and I was enormously impressed, this is later, by the paper of Hammett and Flexner, which did the photographic UV that allowed Hammett to determine the, to demonstrate and determine the pK for the protonation of the benzoic acid and acetophenone. But there was no electronic museum.
Yes. Louis, described that to me on the work that Derek had done, and he said it was just, you know, he had to have a certain kind of graduate student to do it because it was an enormous task.
It was an enormous task, and way off at the frontier. So we didn't have any photographic UV here at Harvard at the time. There were electrochemical measurements. This went back actually to Conant's training with Richards, which he then carried on with the determination of the EMF work on quinones, to which he initiated Fieser, so that all Fieser's work on quinones was actually simply continuation of his PhD thesis with Conant. We will erase this from the tape, but I claim that Louis Fieser never did an original thing in his life. Of course, there was no IR. It hadn't been. There was no IR. I don't know when IR was discovered, but there was certainly no IR instrumentation at all. NMR, of course, hadn't been discovered. Chromatography didn't exist. The labs looked like, I'm sure it looked just like Emil Fischer's labs, except we had Pyrex glass, which was an advantage.
It sort of answers one of my later questions about why the study of acidity seemed to be so intriguing for a number of people, Mohammed and Conant and so on, and it was because the methods were available for doing it, it seems.
I think acidity occupies a fundamental place in chemistry, especially in organic chemistry. When you think about mechanistic organic chemistry, one is repeatedly concerned with the ionization of extremely weak acids and bases. I believe it's a very fundamental problem.
I wonder whether they had that in mind when the early work was done. I mean, to us, in retrospect, it seems as though, you know, sure, that's a natural. And although, you know, Lapworth was dealing with the acidities of the compounds as well, and maybe that's just an offshoot of that. Maybe they did realize what they were, that it was important, and that it would be so important later on.
I'll talk to you about that, because I think I understand some of what Conant was doing.
Okay, that's something I'll get back to.
With respect to acidities. I don't know. This I don't know where we were when we got off on this business.
We were just talking. We were talking about the labs at Dartmouth and at Harvard.
The lab exercises.
Yes. Did you do any research at all at Dartmouth?
The professor of analytical chemistry gave me an analytical problem to try to work on. So I did a little bit, but very little, and it wasn't successful. Furthermore, I was smart enough then to have the same view which I hold today, namely that it is a gross waste of time to do research when you're ill-prepared. I consider most undergraduate research, not all of it, but most of it, a waste of the student's time. I know it's considered, it's very popular today, and my view is an idiosyncratic one, put it as kindly as I can. But it seems to me that for most young people, and of course in advanced mathematics, is a much better expenditure of time and effort than doing undergraduate research. Now, if you need to do the undergraduate research because you're driven to do research then and just have to, then you have to. And for some people, I guess undergraduate research is a way to maintain their interest in science. I had no trouble maintaining my interest in science. I had an enormous amount to learn. I knew I had an enormous amount to learn. I reached out in all sorts of directions to learn different things. I wanted to learn the different things, and I wasn't ready to do research, really. Later in much, much later in my life, I found out that whatever it is I had just learned was exactly what I needed for my research. And since it is absolutely impossible that my judgment was all that good, there is only one conclusion, which is that everyone needs everything for research. There isn't anything you can learn in the area of science that you can't apply to almost every problem. I just wanted to learn more.
Yes. Well, you are probably a rare undergraduate, though, Frank. So many that just want to kind of do.
I didn't want to do then. I wanted to do later.
Well, obviously, paid off. Do you remember any particular students that were friends of yours then that either went on? Well, any particular people that you were close to?
There were relatively few people that I was close to at Dartmouth, certainly in the science. Not very many friends that I've held to then appeared, but they weren't in the sciences. And although I knew some of the people in the science,
I'm interested in people outside the sciences as well, and what courses appealed to you outside the sciences?
I will go back and pick up one of my college friends. Who I have seen, whose name I forgot. I forget everyone's name. My wife says I recognize her 2 times out of 3 if I see her in context. I have terrible trouble with people's names.
Last question.
Go ahead.
Last question about Dartmouth. Were there any courses outside of the sciences that were particularly appealing? Philosophy, literature?
I took a collection of such courses. I guess I enjoyed the course in elementary economics as much as anything outside of the sciences. I found great difficulty with courses in both history and philosophy. And several years signed up for such courses as extra courses over and above my required ones, and then dropped them. I dropped them because I thoroughly disliked the course in philosophy that I tried to take. which seemed to me utterly disorganized and illogical. And I couldn't understand history and quit. Now, subsequently, I've read quite a bit of history and love it. Mm-hmm. And believe I've learned some. The summer after my first year of graduate work, I spent reading history books and went through 2 volumes of world history and 2 volumes of American history with enormous attention. What happened was the following. History as taught at Dartmouth, and history as written in most of the textbooks that were then available, did not distinguish between well-established fact, conclusions from those facts, and pure prejudices of the textbook writer. And I didn't know what was wrong. I just knew that I was terribly uneasy with the history. But I didn't know why. And only after I had done my first year of research in chemistry did it suddenly occur to me what was wrong with history. And then I went back to the history books, and I could read them as if they were written in different colored inks. I could read a sentence and say, yes, that's the kind of thing for which one could have data. Mm-hmm. That could be true. Maybe it isn't true, but it could be true. This is a conclusion that the author has drawn from the facts. I can examine whether I think it's right. And this is pure hypothesis. There's no way that anyone could know that or conclude that. That's just the author's personal speculation. And once that was established for me, I could and did read a great deal of history. Mm-hmm. But at Dartmouth, it was hopeless. So there were, most of the things outside of the sciences at Dartmouth, I rejected. I took the English courses I was required to take. They didn't teach me to write. I waited for James Sr. to teach me to write.
Right.
Took the standard course in psychology. One of the hour exams was given in an overheated room, and I fell asleep. I only had 20 minutes to write the exam, which turned out to be plenty because the damn thing, of course, had no content anyway. So I was not utterly fascinated outside of mathematics. I also was not fascinated by the biology course. Mm-hmm. I took the biology course because I thought, when I was there, maybe I would want to go into medicine. I took the biology course. Well, the biology course was a pure memorization course. Perhaps the instructor, whom I hated, whose name I know perfectly well, but I think I might as well not give you, perhaps he wasn't so much to blame, because the application of biochemistry to biology was a whole generation in the future, and there wasn't anything to do except memorize the stuff. But I really hated it. Besides that, I was not terribly skillful at dissection and abhorred the sight of blood, which convinced me I shouldn't go into medicine.
You were just about at the point to
when I came to Harvard.
You're talking about the courses you were, I think you had taken the preliminary examinations and you'd been asked to take
certain courses. And then you began research immediately then at Harvard.
Oh. Just as you started
just
to take
you started,
your...
you took a couple of courses and you started research. If you passed your qualifying exams reasonably well.
Okay. Well, tell me about the courses and then...
No, I want to tell you about something else.
Okay, good.
So, Conant was chairman of the department. He came in and told me I'd passed my qualifiers, that I should take these two courses, and that I should look to see whom I should do research with in organic chemistry, pointing out that I had a choice between Kohler and Fieser. And I said, sir, I came to Harvard to work with you. When I wrote and applied, I applied to work with you. This is why I'm here. I want to do the kind of work in physical organic chemistry, because I don't know if the word was available then, but in understanding organic reactions that you do, that's... When you accepted me, I thought you had accepted me to do that. He said, well, no, we just accepted you into Harvard, and my research group is full. I can't take any more people. You'll have to decide, see Professor Kohler, see Professor Fieser, see if one of them will take you on this research. Goodbye. So, I went away, and 2 weeks later, Kohler, who was an extremely good administrator, called me back in his office. And he said, I have no record that you've signed up for research. Have you seen Professor Fieser and Professor Kohler? And I said, no, sir, I came to Harvard to work with you, and I was waiting for you to take me on. He said, but I told you I can't take you on. I said, well, that's why I'm here. I'd rather wait. So 3 weeks later, he took me on. Which is, what?
So that's how it happened.
I became Conant's last graduate student. Because in the spring of that year, he became president of Harvard.
Mm-hmm.
And I was very much the last one he took.
Mm-hmm.
And he put me on a problem which never amounted to anything, and which I completed after he was no longer available.
That was the semi-carbazone.
That was the semi-carbazone formation, 60% of the salicylic. But you can see that he was concerned with solvent effects on acids and bases, and he set me up to determine the quote pH, unquote, of that system using a selenium electrode, which had recently been advocated. It was a terrible electrode. It didn't work worth a damn. But that's what I was supposed to do. So I got... But you can see how Conant was thinking in terms of acids and bases and solvents.
Mm-hmm.
So that piece of work was... Well, I completed it all by myself, and I didn't know what I was doing. It wasn't a great piece of research. And after Conant left, I had to decide what to do, and I seriously thought of working with Pistakowski in physical chemistry.
Mm-hmm.
And then decided that, no, I didn't really want to be a physical chemist. I wanted to be an organic chemist.
Mm-hmm.
And did a piece of research with Kohler, which started out quite differently than it ended.
Mm-hmm.
He told me to do a condensation reaction. I don't think he had much in mind.
Mm-hmm.
And it led in entirely different directions than he had expected or I had expected. And it's quite interesting. Kohler almost completely gave me my head in for seconds. He assigned me this problem. And then, for practical purposes, didn't discuss it. He came around to see me once a week,
quite regularly.
Came around and looked at my bench and said to me, "Mr. Westheimer, what did you do last week?" And I would tell him. And he would say, "What are these setups on your desk?" And I would tell him. And he would say, "And what are you planning for next week?" And then he would stand there for a while, nodding his head a little bit. And then he would say, and turn on his heel and walk away.
Did you ever find out what that meant?
I never found out what that meant. I took it to mean that I was getting along all right, that I was doing some stupid things, but I would find out for myself what they were, and that was best.
Okay.
Now, whether that's what that meant or not, I shall never find out. Toward the end of the first year, I came up with an explanation for the very complicated series of chemical reactions that I had uncovered, which explanation was turned out to be almost right, and brought it into Kohler. And again, I don't think he said anything much beyond poop. It turned out that one of the compounds I had led to the formation of a furanol. And Max Tischler took up that work and actually made the furanol, and we have a joint publication with Kohler and Tischler.
And Tischler was working with Kohler?
With Kohler. He was Kohler's private assistant. He had his PhD with Kohler. Maybe for his private assistant. And in contrast to the situation at Dartmouth, where there was no one in the sciences with whom I was very close. Max and I have been good friends since the days of before he got his PhD, and he was a graduate student, and I was a graduate student.
Mm-hmm.
And it wasn't merely that we collaborated on a paper. We didn't really collaborate on that paper. It was done two pieces quite far apart. But we were friends then, and have been friends ever since.
Mm-hmm.
Discussed science together, everything else under the sun.
Any other students at the time you were talking to?
One of Konitz's students was a scientific friend, a personal friend, really, Reginald Bryce Kennell, who is the son of the professor of Kennelly of the Kennelly layer. Kennelly got his PhD when I did, and was an industrial chemist, as I recall, with Monsanto, and died quite young. I don't remember when, but very young. I would bet he died in his 30s. I have no idea how. And I was scientifically friendly with and somewhat influenced by a postdoctoral opponent named Bacon Chow. I pronounce his name Joe. And I was not friendly with, but knew and in a way admired Emma Dietz, who was one of Conant's postdoctorals. So I think it's interesting there was a female postdoctoral in the department at that time. Probably not too common.
No.
What?
No, I'm sure it wasn't. Do you remember who? Do you remember who that was?
Emma Dietz.
Oh, Emma. I'm sorry. Okay. I was thinking of someone else. Okay.
She has a married name now, and doesn't go by the name of Dietz at all. I should remember her married name. I'll think of it eventually. Especially if you remind me that I'm
okay.
I'm missing her married name. And there were quite a number of other people here at the time. Mel Newman was a postdoctoral with Fieser, and he and I were